This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Doug Preston. He's author of many books, both fiction and nonfiction, including one of my favorites, The Monster of Florence. He's author of a forthcoming National Geographic article called Lure of the Lost City, which we will be talking about today. He will be speaking at the Lenzic Center for Performing Arts on Tuesday, the 20th of October. It's a benefit for the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So you got involved as a writer on an expedition to the rainforest of Honduras, where there are all kinds of places that have been actually unexplored by science. I mean, first of all, it's amazing to me that there are still places like that on Earth.
Well, it is incredible to think about. The Mesquitia jungle covers some 32,000 square miles of Honduras and parts of Nicaragua. And it's extremely mountainous. It has some of the densest jungle in the world, surrounded by swamps in a country which has the highest murder rate in the world. And when you combine all these things together, it actually means that there are some parts of these interior mountains of Honduras that actually remain completely unexplored scientifically. And it's hard to believe in the 21st century that would be the case, but it is indeed the case.
And it's so pristine that there are animals there that aren't afraid of humans because they haven't seen them. Did you witness this?
Well, we did. We explored a valley, an unnamed valley, deep in the mountains. And when we first arrived, it was extraordinary. The animals were wandering in and out of our camp. They were completely unafraid. The spider monkeys above us were not only unafraid, but they were really pissed off that we were there. They recognized us as invading primates, and they were, you know, hanging from their tails and screeching and shaking branches at us and throwing things. And then after we didn't go away, they ended up sitting in the trees above us, staring down with absolute fascination as we stared up at them with the same fascination. It was kind of funny.
Yeah. Now, you were there to look for a kind of mythological lost city, a city belonging to a culture so old and so unknown that it doesn't even have a name. What are the roots of this? I mean, what do we know, and what made this expedition happen?
Well, you know, it's a long story, and it actually goes back to the time of Cortez, the conquistador, who heard rumors of very rich provinces, richer than Mexico in the interior of Honduras. And he recorded all this and sent a letter to Charles V describing all these stories about this rich area. But he was never able to explore it because the interior of Honduras is just so absolutely impenetrable. But it seems that started it. These rumors of a lost city or cities, or some great, you know, lost culture hidden in the jungles of Mosquitia in central Honduras has persisted to this day. And some have called it the White City, La Ciudad Blanca, and others have called it the Lost City of the Monkey God. And during the 20th century, there were a number of expeditions that actually searched for it. I mean, legitimate scientific expeditions mounted by the Smithsonian, the Museum of the American Indian, and so forth. And these expeditions invariably brought back, you know, extremely interesting artifacts and stories about ruins and stories about the lost city. And so our story begins kind of in the mid-90s when I was doing some research for another National Geographic article on Cambodia. And I was at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, which is a branch of NASA. And there was a guy there named Ron Blum, who was one of the world's experts on remote sensing of the Earth from space. They had mounted a, a synthetic aperture radar in the space shuttle, and they were looking at jungles of the world, trying to see if this radar could penetrate the jungle foliage. And they discovered an unknown temple in Cambodia. And when I was out there interviewing this guy, Ron, he happened to mention that they were also looking for a lost city in Honduras, the White City, La Ciudad Blanca. And so I followed up on that, and I tracked down a guy named Steve Elkins who was leading this effort. And that's how I got involved. It was in the late 90s, and that's where the whole story began.
It's interesting, the technology that they're using, because it's a kind of, I mean, is it a kind of radar? It's called LIDAR. They send out essentially light and see what comes back. It works kind of like, how does it work?
Well, it's very interesting. It's an extremely powerful technology. What happened was at the JPL, they were using radar. But the radar wasn't really able to do anything except, you know, get some very vague outlines of something that looked unnatural in this valley that they named Target 1 or T1. And so Steve Elkins tried to mount an expedition into this valley that was completely unexplored in the late 90s, but Hurricane Mitch came and basically destroyed the country of Honduras. It was a tremendous, many thousands died, and something like 75% of the roads in the country were destroyed. So Elkins put this project on hold. But then in 2010, he read about this new technology called LIDAR, which is short for Light Detection and Ranging. And what it is it's a million-dollar machine that you mount on a plane, and the plane flies a lawnmower pattern over a section of jungle. And this machine is shooting 125,000 laser beams a second down at the jungle foliage and registering the return and measuring the distance. And it's true that even in the thickest jungle, once in a while, one of those laser beams will strike the ground and come back up through holes in the leaves. So this machine then takes all this information, and they're able to process it using powerful computers to remove the jungle foliage and actually see what is on the ground in great detail. It's quite extraordinary. You can, in the Honduran jungle, the resolution is less than a meter, 3 feet. You can see something that's a meter size or larger. So Elkins raised $1 million of private money to LIDAR this valley in Honduras, and they brought a plane down from the University of Houston, which is where the National Center for Airborne Laser Mapping is located, and they brought down a bunch of engineers. And I was part of that expedition. This was in 2012 now. And the plane, I remember, Steve asked me to join this expedition as the writer, but I was very skeptical that they were going to find anything. It just seemed like such a crazy shot in the dark. But they flew over this valley, they brought the data in, they uploaded it to Houston, and the next day, I'll never forget the engineer, the mapping engineer, rushing out of his cottage in Honduras, where we were based, on the island of Roatan. He was completely freaked out. He was in his flip-flops and running and saying, "My God, there's something in the valley! There's something in the valley!" And we all rushed in and looked at these images, and there it was, a lost city. It was plazas, extensive mounds, earthworks, an unmistakable pyramid, and, terracing, canals. It was absolutely incredible that in the late, in the early 21st century, that a city could be discovered, completely unknown city lost in the jungle.
What kind of materials does a place have to be made of for LIDAR to detect it? Because, I think one of the things that's so interesting about this story is that when you don't use stone or when you use less stone, your entire civilization, like if you make houses of adobe, they will return to the earth in a way that is really not detectable. So what was the LIDAR detecting materially?
Well, it was detecting large mounds and an earthen pyramid and other, remains of earthworks, because the this culture, which is about which almost nothing is known, it doesn't even have a name, were neighbors of the Maya. Copan is only 200 miles to the west, and this culture had many of the characteristics of the Maya, but instead of building their cities out of cut limestone, as the Maya did, they built them out of piles of stone and then earth, and then adobe and wattle and daub and so forth. So even though they built pyramids and temples that were probably as spectacular as the Maya, because they were all carefully finished out and painted and so forth, once the city was abandoned, these great edifices sort of dissolved in the rainforest and rotted away, leaving giant mounds. But what they did leave behind were mounds and extensive areas where the floor of the jungle was leveled so that it was completely flat, for ceremonial areas, for open plazas and things like that. And they also modified earthen hills into pyramids and then would build structures on top. What these pyramids were for, no one has any idea. But they also appeared to build ball courts like the Maya. So they had the Mesoamerican ball game there as well. So that's what the LIDAR detects, are these mounds left from this great civilization.
We're talking to Doug Preston about the lost city in the Honduran rainforest. Now, how do you... First of all, you've got an expedition made up of all kinds of people, not just archaeologists, and you can tell us about that. How do you get there?
Well, in 2012, when they realized they had a very large ruined city, which, by the way, was almost as large as the core of Copan, an archaeological discovery isn't really made until it's been ground-truthed. So they realized that in order to really determine what they'd found, they had to send an expedition in there. But it's in one of the most inhospitable and difficult-to-reach places on the Earth. And the only way really to go in was by helicopter. But, of course, the problem is that you've got this gigantic triple-canopy rainforest. I mean, where are you going to land a helicopter? Well, in LIDARing this entire valley, they did discover some open areas where the vegetation alongside of the river, it's an extraordinary valley. It almost looks like the Lost World. It's completely surrounded by mountains, and the only access point is a steep notch in these mountains that the river flows out of. But inside the valley of T1, alongside the river, there are some open areas where the vegetation was only about 9 feet deep. So it looked like something that they could drop people in with machetes and chainsaws and clear, and then they could land a helicopter. And so that's what they did. In February of this year, I was part of the first expedition into this lost city to see what it looked like. And it was a 3-week expedition, and it was extraordinary. We found everything we saw on LIDAR, we found on the ground, and a lot more. I mean, extraordinary things. It was absolutely amazing.
When you put together a group of people to do this work, it's not just archaeologists, writers, scientists. You basically need a survival team.
Well, we did, and the way the expedition was organized was we had 3 ex-British SAS officers who were experts in jungle survival, who planned the logistics of the expedition, because they knew that this area was extremely hostile, very dangerous. There are a lot of dangerous animals there. The area is full of poisonous snakes and also rife with dangerous tropical diseases. I mean, it looks beautiful from the air. I mean, it looks like a Garden of Eden, but when you're actually on the ground, you realize that things are not, that you're really interlopers in a very hostile and dangerous, tropical jungle environment. So we had these 3 SAS guys. We had, because this was a joint Honduran-American expedition, of course we did this with the full cooperation of Honduras, we had a group of Honduran soldiers who were providing security, and not just for us in the jungle where we didn't need security because we're far from human habitation, but also getting to that point you know, going from Tegucigalpa to Catacamas, which is a very dangerous town that was recently ruled by narco traffickers, which is right at the edge of the jungle. We had to have security, and so these Honduran soldiers provided security. So we had Honduran soldiers. We had three archaeologists, an anthropologist, a couple of ethnobotanists who would look at the plant life and see if they could see anything from you know, that may have been left over from when the civilization existed. We had a LIDAR engineer who brought a $120,000 portable LIDAR machine that he could set up and LIDAR anything that was found. And then a number of other people who were part of the expedition. And I was the writer working for National Geographic magazine, and there was a photographer from National Geographic as well named Dave Yoder. And there was also a film group, like a video team that were shooting film for an eventual documentary.
One of the things that I think is important, a lot of the time when in remote places science makes a brand new discovery, it's something that the local people, the indigenous people, have known all along. Is this a place, is this a site that the local people are aware of?
That's a very interesting question, because in most of the Mosquitia jungle in Honduras, it's the local people, the indigenous people, who are the Pesh and the Tawaka, who know where the sites are. And archaeologists go to them and say, where are the sites? And they get taken there. In this particular valley, there's no human habitation whatsoever. There was absolutely no indication that this valley had been entered by humans since the city basically was abandoned around 1500. So for 500 years, it looks like there were no people in this valley. There were no trails, no sign of any kind of indigenous activity. And, later on, I can probably explain why that is. But at the time we were there, it was very puzzling, because it's a beautiful valley. It's well-watered. It is true that it's extremely difficult to access because of the mountains around it. But once you're in there, it looks like a fairly ideal place to live. But we didn't understand at the time all the dangers that were there.
So how did you get to the site? I mean, you helicopter into a kind of landing area by the river, as you said, but then you've still really got to make your way to the site. There's no map. How did you get there? And then what was that like when you arrived?
Well, it was incredible. I've never experienced anything like it. The landing zone, they dropped a couple of SAS officers, you know, these soldiers, who then cleared the landing zone with machetes in a huge grove of bird of paradise flowers. I mean, these, you know, it was just unbelievable grove of flowers. They chopped them all down, you know, and then the helicopter, it was only big enough for a very small helicopter to land. So I had originally flown in a Honduran army or Air Force helicopter, but it was too big to land there, so I had to turn around, and then they brought me in and everyone else in this very small helicopter that landed. And basically the head of the SAS guys who were leading the expedition handed me a machete and a hammock and said, go off in the jungle and find a place to set up your hammock.
Wow.
You know, this was not the Mosquitia Hilton by any means. It was very rugged. And since we were the first ones in, there was no support there or anything. And we had to wear snake gaiters. There's extreme danger of poisonous snakes. They're very, very common, and they're very, very deadly, much, much deadlier than rattlesnakes. The main poisonous snake there is called a ferdelance, and it's one of the most poisonous snakes in the world. It actually kills more people in the New World than any other poisonous snake, and they're very aggressive, and they're everywhere. Very common.
Oh, my goodness. Did you see them?
Yes, we did. We saw them every single day. And, in fact, the first night we were there, I was walking back to my hammock. It was in the dark, and we had just had a feeble flashlight. And there was a gigantic ferdelance coiled up in striking position right underneath the LIDAR engineer's hammock. And so I called out to I called out. I said, hey, you guys, there's a really big snake here, and he's right in our camp. So the British guys came over, and one of them had to catch the snake and kill it. It was one of the most horrific things I've ever seen, the venom spraying everywhere and covering him with venom, and it was just awful.
Oh, my goodness. Well, and that's not the only danger. I mean, there's diseases, parasites, incessant rain, and predators.
Well, there are, yeah. We heard, I didn't hear it, but some of the anthropologists who were camped kind of in the back, a couple of nights heard a jaguar prowling around their tents. You know, the jaguar apparently makes a very curious kind of rumbling, purring sound, but much deeper than a cat. It's quite distinctive. I was kind of glad I didn't hear that. But anyway, so yeah, it was the day we landed, it rained constantly. I mean, it's just an absolutely wet environment, and you get wet right away, even with a raincoat, and then you're just completely soaking wet for the entire time you're there. So we were there for 8 or 9 days, just soaking wet all the time. No way to escape the moisture, no way to escape the insects, which are crawling all over you, the chiggers all over you, in your sleeping bag at night, the sand flies and mosquitoes. It's just awful. But, you know, it's what you expect in the jungle.
Maybe that's why no one lives there?
Well, I'll get to that a little bit later, why nobody lives there. But the actual entry into the city was an experience I've never had before, and I don't think I'll ever have again. Because the first day we were in, the archaeologist, the chief archaeologist, was very impatient to cross the river and go up into the city. He had the LIDAR maps indicating where it was, where the pyramid was, and he had a Trimble GPS unit, which indicated exactly where he was, and he was standing on the banks of the river, pacing back and forth and saying, when are we going to go? When are we going to go? It's just 200 meters from here. You're looking at this absolute wall of jungle. You can't see anything in it. But he says, there's a pyramid 200 meters from here, right across the river. And we couldn't see it. But eventually, we crossed the river, waded across the river, and our British guys, with their machetes, cut a path through this absolutely just impenetrable jungle. And we came to the side of the pyramid, and we climbed up it. It was very steep. You couldn't see anything at all. I mean, I took photographs, and you have no idea what you're looking at. It's just green vegetation everywhere. And when we got to the top, we saw the remains of what appeared to be buildings, you know, walls, which confirmed to the archaeologist that it was a pyramid. And then the Honduran archaeologist with us did a small test cut in the side, and he said he could see evidence of rammed earth construction. So it indicated it was an artificial hill.
We're talking to Doug Preston about the lost city in the Honduran rainforest. And you were just talking about how you walked up this pyramid. Now, you didn't even really, you wouldn't have known that it was a pyramid except for this LIDAR technology. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, one of the things that it's hard to imagine is that you can't see anything in the jungle. Even if you step 5 or 10 feet away from other people, you vanish. You know, we all had to carry whistles, and that's how you kind of keep track of each other is by hearing sound. So that there isn't any way to see the city spread out. You have no sense, even though it's a huge city, you're standing in the middle of it, you have absolutely no sense that you're standing in the middle of a city. We then, from the top of the pyramid, we walked down into the main, there are about 10 plazas to this city, but we walked down into the main plaza, and that was when we started finding things. We found, you know, this huge row of massive, what looked like altar stones, flat stones placed on tripods of quartz boulders, and found what looked like a stone staircase kind of leading up into nothing. And the second day in in this area we were exploring. We found, really made the major discovery of the time, we found an incredible cache of stone sculptures that had been left at the base of the pyramid, and just their tops were peeking above the surface of the ground, you know, jaguar heads and snakes and you know, zoomorphic figures, what looked like carved stone, giant stone vessels with snakes on the rims and vulture heads, and these stone thrones or ceremonial seats that they call matatis. They're not grinding platforms. They look like grinding platforms, but they're huge, decorated with geometric figures and jaguar heads and animal heads and so forth. I mean, all this was like lying there. There are 52 of them, and many more obviously below, you know, almost completely buried in the jungle. It was a stunning discovery. They've been left there probably 500 or 600 years ago and have just remained there absolutely untouched until we came upon them.
That must be the kind of moment that an archaeologist spends their whole life waiting for and just living for.
Well, it is. I mean, I've been on many archaeological digs, and they tend to be very slow, and you never find anything really unless you're really lucky. And it's mostly, you know, just a very slow process. But in this instance, we came across this spectacular array of sculptures, all in absolutely perfect condition, carved out of black basalt, a rhyolite, and just gorgeous pieces. I mean, and they're not really Maya in appearance. This is a different culture, and they had a different artistic sensibility. But, of course, nobody has any idea what these pieces mean, why they were left there. Were they offerings to the pyramid, or were they left there when the city was abandoned? It's just nobody knows anything about this culture. They don't know why, what these pieces signified and why they were left there.
Now, there was this explorer, Theodore Mord, who in, what was it, the 1930s or 40s, went to Honduras looking for a legendary lost city, came back with crates full of artifacts, eventually committed suicide. Nobody really knows exactly what these things were or where they came from. Did the things that you found resemble the things that he brought back? In other words, was he, obviously he wasn't at that site, but was he at the site of the same people, at a site of the same people?
Yes, he was, exactly. The things we brought back were exactly like what he brought back, and it was certainly the same culture. Just to give a little background for the audience, the Museum of the American Indian sent three expeditions into Honduras in the 1930s looking for what they were calling the lost city of the monkey god, and the first two heard a lot of rumors but didn't find it. And finally they sent this guy named Theodore Mord, who went deep into Honduras and claimed to have found it. Now, I've seen Mord's journals, and they're really ambiguous, and I'm not sure he was... He found something, but he may have exaggerated it a great deal. But he did bring back some pretty extraordinary artifacts, which are now in the collections of the Smithsonian. But he refused to reveal the location of the city. He did not write the location down in his journal. And the only indication of where it might be were strange numbers carved on his walking stick that he kind of obsessively carried with him through the jungle, indicating like northeast, northwest, southeast, and then numbers. And no one has ever been able to decipher this walking stick or you know, whether these were indeed directions to the lost city of the monkey god he claimed to have found. But he never went back. He said he was going to go back, but this was in 1940, and then World War II intervened. And by the time the war was over, Ward actually was in the OSS, which is sort of the precursor to the CIA. He was involved in spying and the military and everything, and he never was able to return to Honduras to explore the lost city.
At that time, I mean, right now we have a kind of archaeology where you are extremely careful about leaving things where they are because it's easier to understand things when they're in context, and as soon as they're taken out of context, a lot of meaning vanishes. In Theodore Mord's time, was that the practice, or was he like taking stuff? I mean, we don't know what the sites were, but do you think he was just taking things off-site, out of context?
Yes, he was. I mean, he was not an archaeologist, and he was not a careful researcher. There were other archaeologists in his day working in Honduras who were far more careful. Moore just collected artifacts. He didn't keep good notes. We don't know where they came from. It was just really unfortunate. Most of the people who explored in Mosquitia at that time were not very careful, with the exception of William Duncan Strong, who was sent there by the Bureau of American Ethnology in the Smithsonian, and he kept very good notes and kept track of everything, and he made maps of some of the sites that he found, and that was really the beginning of good archaeology in Honduras in this area.
What is the practice like now, and what did you observe archaeologists actually doing on the site? It seems like they were very careful not to touch anything. Describe that to us.
Well, that's right. The archaeologists with us, were their only goal was to map the site and to ground truth what was seen from the air and to see if there was anything else on the ground. So when this cache of artifacts and sculptures was discovered, no one was allowed to touch them, to move them, or to dig them up, or even to clear, other than clearing loose leaves from around them. That was all that the archaeologists allowed us to do. Now, this cache of sculptures is very valuable and could be looted. And so the Honduran government, actually, after we left, they brought in a unit of soldiers to guard it, to make sure it wasn't touched. It will have to be excavated because of the problem of looting. You just can't leave something like that in the jungle in Honduras. It will be looted. I mean, this is an area that's where, you know, there's a lot of narco trafficking, not in this immediate area, but in the surrounding area, and they have planes, they have helicopters, and they, you know, eventually could loot this stuff. So they're going to excavate it. It's going to be the first time that a cache like this has ever been excavated from this culture. It's going to be done with extreme care, and hopefully it will reveal quite a lot about the culture. Why were these things left here? Were these huge stone jars, did they contain something like chocolate or offerings? Are there royal burials underneath, artifacts and things like that? There are going to be a lot of discoveries made when they finally excavate it, but it's going to be done with very great care.
I read the National Geographic article with great interest, and it's. I mean, you cannot tell at all from this article where this place is, except in the most general terms. I guess looters and narco traffickers read National Geographic.
Well, they do. I mean, they do. The one thing that saves this place, well, there are two things saving this place. One is that you really can't get in there except by helicopter. I mean, if you're going to mount a ground expedition in there, it's going to be many weeks going through the jungle, and it's going to be... And then how are you going to get that stuff out? There are no roads. There are no trails. The only way to travel is up the rivers, but the rivers are fast-moving water with waterfalls and roaring torrents, and it's just not... you just can't get anywhere. I mean, these very steep mountains where the slopes are 45 degrees and covered with jungle. So the only way to get in there is with a helicopter. So I think it's the isolation that's going to protect these things. Also, and this is getting to why nobody lives in this valley, it turns out that the valley was a hot spot of a very serious tropical disease called leishmaniasis, which after the expedition was over and we all went back to our lives. I mean, you're covered with bug bites. You're covered with these red marks all over your body. But after about a month or two, all the bug bites go away. But a number of us noticed that there was one bug bite that wasn't going away and was starting to get worse. And it turns out that we were all infected with a disease called leishmaniasis and a very virulent and dangerous strain of the disease called mucosal leishmaniasis, which is It's essentially a flesh-eating parasite that eventually moves to your nose and mouth, and basically your nose and mouth fall off, and the big open sore remains where your face was.
It's
horrible.
Do you have this, Doug?
I do.
What do you do about it?
Well, the National Institutes of Health, which is our, in Bethesda, Maryland, was very interested. They're studying leishmaniasis. It's the second deadliest tropical disease in the world, parasitic disease after malaria. And they were fascinated with what had happened to this expedition, that everyone, 23 people on the expedition came down with this. So they offered to treat everyone for free to study exactly, to study the disease and why we all got it and what strain of leishmaniasis it was. And it turns out it was a strain that they've never seen before, and unfortunately a really bad strain, very difficult to cure. Those of us who've gone through the treatment, it appears that it didn't work. So, I don't mean to horrify your audience, but I mean, they're going to have to do something else. They're going to have to figure out what to do next. I actually have to go to the doctor in a couple of days to get an evaluation. But.
Yeah. Well, I hope there are some kinds of cures for that, because basically everybody in the group has this?
Well, not everyone. Not everyone got it. About, 60 to 70% got it, and there were some that didn't. And it's not contagious. I'm not going to give it to anybody else. It's like malaria. It's a parasite that you get through the bite of a sandfly as opposed to a mosquito. And it goes through a life cycle in your body, and it gets in your bloodstream, and then it causes these problems. Unfortunately, the treatment is extremely unpleasant. It's a type of chemotherapy that makes you feel very sick.
Because
they're trying to poison the parasite in your body, and they're pushing it as hard as they can.
Which is not probably so great for all the cells in your body. Well, we will get an update on that. Meanwhile, we're talking to Doug Preston about the National Geographic article, Lure of the Lost City, the lost city in the Honduran rainforest, that as yet has no name, the civilization has no name, in this expedition. And of course, there will be more expeditions to come if anybody's willing to subject themselves to those dangers. What so far have you learned about the people who lived in this city?
Well, we've, some is known, not much, but some. There are some archaeologists who believe that what happened was this civilization flowered around 1000 AD, around 900 to 1000 AD, which is just at the time when the Maya collapse was occurring. And so there's some archaeologists who think that maybe an elite group of Maya came down into this area and took over, kind of being dispersed by the Maya collapse. There are others who think that, no, the Maya did not come and rule over these people, but actually this civilization just borrowed aspects of their powerful neighbors. But they do appear to have been very like the Maya in the way they laid out their cities. They did have the ball game, but their objects, these carved objects that we found, really don't look all that Maya. They're not totally dissimilar, but they really do indicate that this is a completely different culture, with a different, a sense of aesthetics. So that's pretty much all they know. They know that the civilization flowered, had a great period of ascendancy in the period from 1000 AD to probably about 1500, and then it absolutely vanished. They completely vanished. And the leading theory is that they were wiped out by European diseases, even though Europeans never got into this culture because they've never found any indication of Spanish conquest. But diseases did spread into the interior of Honduras and devastated these cities and probably caused a complete civilization-wide collapse around 1500, all these cities were abandoned, and the jungle just came back and covered it up, and that's it.
I think it's important to point out that we're not just talking about one city. We're talking, as you said, about a bunch of cities, a real civilization, a lost civilization.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, these myths about the legend of the white city or the lost city of the monkey god, you know, clearly were based in truth. But the truth is that this was not a lost city. This was an entire lost civilization. There were many cities, many white cities or many lost cities of the monkey god present in the Mosquitia rainforest, and they're absolutely, without doubt, others waiting to be discovered. In fact, the LIDAR survey showed a city in another target area called T3, which has not even been visited yet. It's still completely isolated in the jungle and is unknown to archaeology except what was seen in the LIDAR images. So, you know, in my talk, just to mention that I will be speaking at the Lenzik on October 20th, and I'll be showing images that have never been seen in public before of the city, of the discovery, some of the LIDAR images, and I'll also show some images of T3, which has not yet been explored. And it should be a very interesting evening because it's not often that you discover a lost city.
Do you think that the specter of leishmaniasis is going to keep people from wanting to explore further?
Well, it will. I mean, it's a huge deterrent. I mean, it wasn't just us Americans that got it. The Hondurans also got the same disease. I mean, you know, the Honduran soldiers, many of whom are actually indigenous to the people who were indigenous to Mosquitia, also got this very bad strain of leishmaniasis. And it was so bad that the Honduran army almost pulled them out because they were all getting sick. So, you know, I mean, that is certainly an explanation of why there aren't indigenous people in the valley. It may even be connected in some way to the loss of the city, to the abandonment of the city. It's hard to say. I certainly don't want to go back there. I mean, and it wasn't just the leishmaniasis. I mean, there's chikungunya, there's Chagas disease, there's dengue fever, and there are these poisonous snakes, pterodactyls, that we saw every single day, and it was just a miracle somebody wasn't bitten. And to be bitten by a pterodactyl is very often fatal.
Now, all of this is happening, and it's so strange when you talk about collapses of civilizations. I mean, here you have a pristine rainforest that nobody has gone to for many hundreds of years. But this is happening in the context of a nation, Honduras, which is being very quickly deforested for cattle grazing. And that has a bearing on archaeology and archaeological sites.
Exactly. The Honduran, the Mosquitia jungle is being illegally clear-cut. And when we were flying over into this region, we flew helicopters from Catacamas into Mosquitia. We flew over huge clear-cut areas where all the trees are just being left on the ground. I mean, on the ground, actually, they're being left on these very steep mountainsides. And I was looking at this and thinking, you know, this is not timbering. They're clearing for some other reason. And I looked into it, and it turns out they're clearing for cattle grazing. In fact, this area of Central America is one of the largest beef-producing areas in all of Central America. They're clear-cutting these mountains and putting cattle out there. And it's with the clear-cutting comes archaeological looting, because as they uncover sites, naturally, they're looted. I mean, this stuff is really valuable. And in a country that just doesn't have a lot of government control of the interior, it's a huge problem. So preserving the rainforest is, and preserving these archaeological sites are one and the same thing. The two go hand in hand.
Very interesting, because, I mean, the environment, the wild nature that eats up and covers over places where people used to live is also preserving those very places.
It is. I mean, at the height of the city that we found in T1, the archaeologist sort of described to me what it was like. It wasn't thick, impenetrable jungle at all. It was almost like a Garden of Eden with cleared open areas, gardens full of useful plants, plantations of chocolate trees or mangoes, flower gardens, areas where there are medicinal plants, open areas with sight lines to ceremonial architecture, pyramids, and so forth. It would have been a very different environment 500 or 600 years ago at the height of the civilization than it is today. I mean, it's just impenetrable jungle. You can't see anything. I've got photographs of the pyramid that just look like nothing but leaves.
So the cycle of nature that made this thick rainforest is part of a larger cycle, and it was genuinely different before. It wasn't just the hand of human beings clearing or changing the land. It was a different land, is what you're saying.
Well, it was the hand of the builders of the city who cleared areas and sort of transformed the jungle into a very friendly environment. One of the characteristics of New World cities are that these garden areas were intermingled with very dense habitation. It's not something that we see in our cities, but in the prehistoric times in New World cities, you often saw that these cities were very dense habitation, would be wedged in among fields, among, you know, plantations, with open areas, really almost like a Garden of Eden. It would have been, or as one of the archaeologists said to me, it was a lot like an English garden, almost like Central Park. You know, it looked like Central Park with vast, you know, grassy areas, trees providing shade, gardens, pathways, houses tucked in among the trees. I mean, it would have been something quite beautiful to see.
So what happens next? When can we hear the next chapter of this story?
Well, tentatively, the excavation of the site is scheduled for January. The National Geographic Society is going to help support it. And that will be sort of the next thing that happens. I imagine there'll be a very large amount of attention paid to when they start bringing these sculptures up and people can see what they really look like. That should be quite spectacular. And that'll take place in January. And then there are plans possibly to LIDAR the entire Mesquite jungle. It would cost about $3 million. But to map this entire civilization has never been done before. And it would be fascinating to do that. It would be a unique project in the history of archaeology.
Is there anything that you want to add and that you want to let people know before we go?
Well, I just want to, invite people to come see the talk on October 20th at the Lenzic Theater. As I said, I'll be showing a number of slides and also some video of the discovery of the city, of our campsite, of the snakes we had to kill. I mean, there are all kinds of exciting images. And the evening is a benefit for the school for advanced research in Santa Fe, so that all money goes to the school and helps support its programs. It's a very worthy organization. So I just say, I hope everyone will come and enjoy these images, which I've never shown before, that have never been seen before in public.
Doug Preston is the author of many books and author of the forthcoming National Geographic article, Lure of the Lost City. And once again, he will be speaking at the Lenzic Center for Performing Arts Tuesday, October 20th, benefit for the School for Advanced Research. Thank you so much for joining us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. This has been very, very enjoyable.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to Studio X for their technical support and web design.